very well. Today is Advent Sunday of hope. And though we can talk about hope from various perspectives, really, to get hope, really, we have to look at it from the context of distress. And so the songs, all fairly thoughtful, kind of gloomy, like the outdoor weather. But that is for the purpose of seeing hope. And that's what we hope to do this morning. This has been a fast study through Habakkuk, very fast. We did that intentionally. We wanted you to remember chapter 1 by the time we got to chapter 3. We wanted to be able to put the story together. We wanted you to be able to see and remember this prophet. We don't know a whole lot about him, but what I know about him is incredibly important to me. And so I wanted to make that important to you. So just 4 weeks ago, for some of you, you were introduced for the very first time to this man, Habakkuk, who we don't know a whole lot about. But remember, Habakkuk began in chapter 1 by just looking around in his culture and looking around Israel and then complaining to God. He saw the wickedness of the land. He saw that they had turned away from God's law, that they had become very nominal, that it's in name only in terms of their Judaism. He looked to the courts. He saw that injustice was actually being practiced. He said in chapter 1, justice is being perverted because the law is being ignored. He looked around the people. He saw that they were a careless people. They were a wicked people. They were strife and destruction, he says, was all around him. He saw violence in the people, and we understood that this was wearisome to him. So he saw what was happening in the people that were called God's people. And he described, he summarized, he said, in my land at this time, God, the righteous are a minority and the wicked are a majority, and the righteous are surrounded by the wicked in Israel. And so this provoked the prophet to ask, how long, O Lord, will this be? And I would suggest, as we talked about, one step further than that. How long, O Lord, is one kind of question. But Lord, do you care about this is another. How long, O Lord, until you act? How long, O Lord, until you set things right? How long before the righteous can flourish again and the wicked will be put down? How long? But really the question that Habakkuk is answering through those words is really more specific and more severe. Because the question is really, Lord, how long will you look at this wrong idly? That is, how long will you just look at this and not do anything? And we looked at the context of chapter 1, and we looked at it through these lenses. We saw that Habakkuk was actually asking a question, God, do you care? And are you going to do anything? In chapter 2, we saw that God had a plan. And God had seen the condition of his people. He'd already taken notice of it. God wasn't surprised by what Habakkuk was reporting to him. He didn't need what Habakkuk was telling him. Oftentimes we find ourselves telling God things that, believe me, God knows. And in chapter 2, we found out that God knows and that God has a plan, and that plan, God knew that that plan would startle Habakkuk. He told him, get ready, Habakkuk. I'm going to tell you something that you're not going to believe. I'm going to tell you something that's going to shake your heart and stir your soul. And indeed it did. Because he told Habakkuk, I have seen the injustice, I have seen the nominalism, I've seen that we've become spiritually cold, and I have a plan, and that plan is to bring the Babylonians into Israel, and by military might, they're going to bring a judgment or a chastisement to my people. Which provoked the second great question of Habakkuk, how in the world can you do that? They're worse than us. And so in that chapter 2, we saw that Habakkuk really focused his attention on two characteristics of God. And he didn't just deal with the characteristics. He was really in the midst of thinking about this. In the midst of, God, how can you possibly be a God who is going to bring about the discipline of one group of people who have gone astray by using the purely wicked in order to do it? And as he wrestled through theologically in his own mind, who is God right now? We saw in chapter 1 that He kind of grabbed onto two characteristics of God, two attributes of God. The first one was that God was everlastingly faithful to the covenant. And in the light of that truth, we got to see chapter 2, verse 4, which was the key verse of the book, that the righteous, that is those that were surrounded by the wicked, mind you, will live by faith in the everlasting God who never forsakes His people. And so that helped us to understand what exactly He was talking about. When he looked at that attribute, it helped us to understand one of the key verses of the Bible, or of the book, if not the key verse of the book. Habakkuk, here's some truth for you. The righteous will live by their faith, by their trust in the faithfulness of God. Then last week we looked at the second attribute that he listed there in chapter 1, verse 13, where he talked about God being purer of purer eyes than to look on evil. He's still questioning in chapter 1, how in the world could you possibly do this? But he fleshes it out. He fleshes it out in chapter 2. How can God use a people who are even more morally destitute than Israel in order to be the rod of correction to Israel themselves? And there we saw that he grasped a hold of the idea that God was holy, and that holiness helped us to understand one of the other key verses of this particular book, when it says that the whole earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, just as the waters cover the sea. And we see that both in His judgment, in His holiness, and in His grace. And so that brings us to this morning in our text in chapter 3, which is a very appropriate text for the first week of Advent as we look at hope in the light of Christmas. Because in chapter 3, we have a record of one of the most precious and well-known texts in all of the Bible, at least in my understanding, in terms of a man's trust in the living God in the midst of adversity. If you want to see a person who's living faithfully in the midst of adversity, Habakkuk offers you a very good picture of what life might look like for us when we ourselves prepare for adversity. At the very center of the hope that we find in chapter 3 is the same center that we found in chapter 1 and chapter 2 already, and that is, the hope here is not in Him. The hope is in God. It's in this faithfulness of God. This is what we've seen all the way through the book. We'll see it again this morning, and we see it in various ways. Because what we continue to see is this, is chapter 2, verse 4, completely and continually being spelled out for us. It's almost like He's driving home this idea for us. The righteous will live. They will not be extinguished. And those righteous who live, they will live by faith, by trust. They will not live by their abilities. They will not live by their strategies. They will not live by their wealth. They will not live by any form of comforts in this life. But the righteous are those who will live by trust. And not just trust in anything. They will live because they will find their trust in the unchanging faithfulness of God. That is the message of Habakkuk. The theme is pressed to us. I think in the very beginning of this chapter, we see this same theme being pressed again in the very opening line. This is a prayer, but it's also a psalm. And I would argue it's maybe more of a psalm than it is a prayer. It is, as you see, the very last line of this section. It's a little note there. Oh, by the way, stringed instruments are better for this. You know, like, well, I don't know what the piano is. The piano's confusing. But maybe it's strings, maybe it's percussion. I don't know what it is. I don't know if anyone knows what it is, but there it is. But he's simply saying, hey, strings are good for this. You can see the musical interest. That little word, Selah, that I think appears five times in the text. It's a musical term. It means, I don't know. I've heard it said, it means think about it. I've heard other people say, I don't know what it means. I've heard other people take guesses. But it's musical, and we know that. We also know from the very first verse there that this is a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to, and then this word, Shiganoth means, it's a musical term that's used in the Bible sparingly, but when it is, it seems to be a psalm that emphasizes the faithfulness of God. So it's not accidental that he calls this thing. So there's some words in this text that even Hebrew scholars don't know exactly what they mean, but we do know they're musical, and we also know that in some cases these are tied to psalms that speak of the faithfulness of God. And so again, we're seeing that this is this whole book is talking to us about how we endure afflictions by putting our faith in something outside of ourselves. And so here in this psalm, it's a psalm that is really pressing us. It's pressing us in times of anguish. It's pressing us in times of affliction. It's pressing us when we're fearing the unknown of tomorrow. And it presses us to put our faith, our trust, in something outside of us. Now, I'll just say from the very outset here, that is not new. If you've been in church, I don't know, if you've been here a year, you have heard those kinds of things said over and over and over again. But this morning, I really, really want to try to impress upon you that these cannot just simply be ideas that, as Calvin says, that flit around in our brains. But we're talking about a military invasion. The Babylonians are coming into Israel, and they are not there to play a game of chess. People are going to die. And in the midst of that, the prophet prepares himself for enduring that trial by focusing attention inwardly, his attention, upon whether or not he can really trust God for this. If you don't feel the weight of that, I'm afraid chapter 3 of Habakkuk is not going to speak to you. You have to put yourself there. This is not just about money, though financial trials are real and they get our attention. This really is about life and death. This really is a theological struggle inside the mind and the heart of the prophet, where he's trying to make sense of how God can do this and still be the God that he's always been. And if you can understand those moments in life when you're a little bit turned upside down and you're asking questions about how does my circumstances right now jive with everything that I've been told is true about God? If you've never been in that place, I suggest to you that you're probably going to be before this life is over. And if you've been in that place, you know just how lost you can feel. It feels like your anchor has been lifted in the midst of a storm, and you are just like Paul, as we saw at the end of Acts. You are just being blown all over the place. Well, that's Habakkuk. I think, essentially, the chapter can be divided into three parts. The first part is probably the most confusing part because it deals with images from history and metaphors and things that maybe we're not so familiar with and we can get lost in. So I'm going to help you with that. But then, and that is that Habakkuk remembers God's faithfulness in the past. That's the first part. The second part is really just verse 16. I just want to focus on that. Habakkuk prepares. So first he remembers. And then, verse 16, he's preparing himself. And then 17 through 19, he looks to the future with confident hope in God. All right, so let's take a look at this. When you read the poetic language of the Psalms, or sometimes even Proverbs, but lots of times in the prophets, you can get so mixed up and confused about what we're talking about. You think we're talking about a historical event that takes place in the times of the kings of Judah and Israel, and you think that's pretty clear until the prophet starts talking, then you have no idea when this is going to take place. Well, the use of metaphor and the use of allusions and those kinds of things can get us kind of confused. So verses 3 through 15, I think, can be confusing. So it's a poetic section dealing with allusions to historical realities. I think most of the imagery all finds its meaning in his recollection of the Exodus, but But some could be outside of that as well. But I'm going to walk you through that as he looks backwards. But I want you to focus on verse 2, because verse 2 helps us to get there. Verse 2 of chapter 3, O Lord, I have heard the report of you, that is in the past, and I have heard then of your work, O Lord, and of you do I fear. Now that word fear can also be translated respect or awe. I don't think that fear meets the context here as well as awe, because he's remembering something in the past, and he's standing, it's having an effect upon him. He's being moved in his affections and his hope. So I think the word awe might fit better than the ESV's rendering of that same word, fear. So I'll give that to you. That's my own thoughts about that. But I think awe fits this context better. It's a funny thing, when they do these translations, they never call me. But you know that's funny, because like today with the college football thing, they're not going to call me. I can't understand that. Politicians don't call me. I'm glad about that. But I just seem to be always outside of those people that make decisions for such things. But I really do think that when you read this in terms of awe, I think you get at least how I'm understanding this particular passage. In other words, he's saying, I'm remembering what you did in the Exodus. I remember how you brought your people out with mighty hand. I remember. And he speaks in verse 3 through 15. He speaks about God in the most interesting of poetic ways and allusions and all the rest and metaphors. And he's basically speaking of God as this divine warrior. And this divine warrior in chapter 3 is one who is supremely powerful over nature. He mentions the rivers, he mentions the deep, he mentions mountains. Oh, I love that. The mountains writhe at his presence. I mean, it's so much visible and visual language. He speaks of the pestilence and the plague, which I think is really easily rooted in the Exodus when Moses brings the people across the Red Sea, delivering them from Egyptian bondage and bringing them into the land of promise. And it seems like most of these images are kind of rooted in that. So he's a divine warrior in verse 3 through 15 who exercises his authority over nature, celestial bodies. He mentions the stars and the moon and other things. And then he depicts God's triumph over the nations, like over Kishon and Midian and the oppressors. Like in verse 13, he says, you march through the earth in fury, that is in judgment. He threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. Verse 13. And so what a graphic picture. And I don't want you to get confused in those words. What a graphic picture of God exercising his dominion, exercising his reign. He's the divine warrior. He's one who acts in sovereign purpose and power. And he's remembering all of these things in the past, because he wants those realities in order to begin to make an effect upon his own soul. So, the prophet is basing his hope in the present and his hope for the future in who God has been and what God has done. If God is the everlasting, unchanging God, then what he has been is what he's hoping he will be again. And that's really the understanding of verse 2. He wants God to do what he did then, again, in our day. And so he says, oh God, renew it. In the midst of the years, that is in history and in time, revive our understanding, and maybe even, I could go so far as to say, our experience of you as the divine warrior. And the last thing he says, and while you're acting out, again, being the divine warrior in our stead, in our place, and for our good, remember mercy, even when we deserve judgment. Remember mercy. I think that helps us to get to the heart of Habakkuk. Mercy is not something extended to people who are innocent. Mercy is something that's extended to people in the light of considering their weakness and understanding their frailty. In the midst of our guilt, but in the light of our weakness, extend grace when we don't deserve it. That's the idea of mercy. In the midst of judgment, God, extend mercy. It's one of the great themes of the Bible, that in the midst of judgment, salvation comes. And I love that verse. the verse right here in verse 13. He goes through the earth in fury during the time of the Exodus. He threshes the nation in anger because he's bringing salvation to his people. Salvation in the midst of judgment. Mercy in the midst of judgment. And so I think if we understand Habakkuk well, I understand that what this prophet is doing, what this prophet is really, his heart, is God, I want to know that experientially. In this looming darkness that's coming, I want to sense and experience the light of your grace even in the midst of it. And so I think maybe to help understand this well, he is not saying, oh God, if you really are what I've been told that you are, then save us from the Babylonians. Instead, he's saying, I know you are what you say you are. And I know you've done what I've heard that you've done. Be that again to us. Do that again in this time. Show us great mercy again as you've shown it before. Even as you are forced to bring us judgment, bring us mercy. Those are completely different things. I think sometimes we as Americans get stuck on the first. If you really are who you are, then save us from this discomfort. I think really the health and prosperity gospel has more influence on us than we would think. Some of us just naturally think that God, if God shows up and God's presence is here, like Habakkuk, who thought that if God would show up, if God would come, he would put all the injustices right and he would take away all the things that cause us discomfort in a moment. He would just do that. That's what happens when God shows up. And yet the Bible is written to tell us that that's not necessarily true, that God is doing something greater than just making us comfortable. But it takes faith to see that. So Habakkuk is saying, I know what you've been. I believe that's true. I know I can trust you. So, oh God, let me experience the same kind of mercy as our forefathers experienced with you. And in the light of a time where we might very well be guilty, will you consider the frailties of our hearts and extend mercy? And so I think we have to ask ourselves the question, in times of affliction, is that our prayer? In times of affliction, do we get alone with God? And do we remember our life with God? Do we remember that we are recipients of unbelievable grace? Do we cast aside all of our fears and look with diligent faith to see the testimony of the Scripture that God is a God who is good and faithful and trustworthy? Is that how we approach difficulties? Habakkuk is looking to the past and he's standing in awe and it's building his heart. The second thing we see in this passage is that Habakkuk prepares for adversity, and this is a very unusual verse, verse 16. Incredibly unusual. In verse 16, we find the prophet. He says, I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound, rottenness enters into my bones, my legs tremble beneath me, yet I will wait quietly, or I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. Now we find Habakkuk is in a very interesting place, and one that we've talked about before. He is in that unusual position of understanding exactly what's going to happen in the future and why. He knows that God is going to use the Babylonians in order to bring chastisement against his people. And he also knows that God, being holy, is not going to give an exemption to the rod that he chooses to use in order to bring that discipline. That it is not ultimately for destruction that God is allowing this to take place in time and history, but rather for the restoration of the people, the restoration of their belief in Him, the turning away from Baals and Ashtaroths and all the rest, and putting their attention back upon God, who is their hope. So Habakkuk understands the cause and effect relationship between the sin of Israel and the carelessness of Israel, and the injustices of the courts. And he understands that nominalism is producing a false kind of, of testimony about who God is, and he's going to use this nation in order to come in and bring discipline to them. Not to ultimately destroy them, but to bring discipline, to restore something that's vital within them. And now the prophet, knowing the future, sits down and has to wrestle with it all. And here I want you to feel the pressure here. I hear from God, and my body trembles. Do you see this? This is no small thing. My body is trembling. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. This is the experience of a person who knows with certainty what is coming. This is like the Lord coming to you and saying, in due time, you will hear these words. I'm sorry, but I think it's cancer. And now your job is just to sit and get ready for that. He doesn't tell you when. He doesn't tell you it's going to be next week. He doesn't tell you it's going to be next month. It's like God is coming to you and saying, you can continue doing all that you're doing financially, but there's coming a day when you will be broke. Every investment in your life is going to go on its head, and it will leave you penniless. It's coming. It's as if God is saying, you are Job, and you are going to suffer great loss in the near future. And verse 16 is you, a picture of you, sitting down alone with God and asking yourself, how in the world am I going to prepare for that? And more than that, how am I going to prepare my heart to trust God when that comes? The thought of it is rottenness in his bones. He feels inside of him there's a rotting. Just the thought of it. And so we have an unusual thing that we get to look upon this man. And I think the question for us is, how would you prepare for that? I mean, really, how would you? The prophet is not just concerned with how is he going to endure physically, but he's also got that second part that Christians all have. How am I not only going to endure this physically? Yes, of course, all of us share that. But how am I going to endure this spiritually? How am I going to go through this with my trust rooted in Christ and him alone? How am I going to trust him to do in me what I desperately need so that I might endure what he has in his own wise, for his own wise and holy reasons, allowed to come to pass? And that's verse 16. You know, Peter wrote to us in 1 Peter 3 some interesting words, kind of in the same light. When Peter's writing to a group of people who are suffering unjustly, that's the way he says it. They were actually being persecuted for their faith. And he writes a letter to them in 1 Peter, and interesting in that letter, he never tells them that I would consider, he never says this as an apostle, I would consider moving to another neighborhood. He doesn't say that. Instead, he says, you know, there's nothing really that unusual about what's happening to you. What's happening to you is happening to all your brothers around the world. And so, this is what's happening to Christians right now. But he does say, in speaking about suffering unjustly, he does say something here that I think is helpful to us. He says, it's a gracious thing when you, being mindful of God, that's the key, being mindful of God, when you endure sorrows while suffering unjustly. For he asks the question, for what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you as an example, so that you might follow in his steps. So that suffering and enduring sorrows in and of themselves provide absolutely no spiritual benefit whatsoever. But suffering with a view to God, being mindful of God, actually transforms the soul. You see, Peter is not saying that it's pleasing to God nearly to suck it up and to endure unjust suffering and sorrow. It is pleasing to God when you're being mindful of God, When we have faith in God in the midst of our situations. It's here that the righteous shall live by faith in God's faithfulness. So it's not a stoic kind of self-motivated tenacity which holds out against all opposition. That's not what he's talking about. It's rather just the opposite. Peter's actually saying that there is an ability of Christians to have a trusting awareness of God's presence and never-failing care in the midst of sorrows and difficulties, in the midst of pregnancies that don't go full term, in the midst of loss, that there is a possibility in the midst of the most ugly of relational conflicts for Christians to have a trusting awareness of God's presence and His never, ever, ever failing care of us. That's what he's saying. And he's saying this is the key to righteous suffering. It is the great confidence of two things. It's the great confidence there is no injustice in this life that will not have to answer to God. And the second is, God uses everything for our good. One of the truths I think that Habakkuk really stresses to us is that as Christians, we can endure injustices under the sovereign hand of God because no injustice will ultimately go unpunished. So that we can endure God's training of us through these injustices because He can be totally trusted with the care and direction of our lives. And this gives us endurance to keep going when we're exposed to occasional injustices, just as it does in all of the afflictions. But combined with that, mixed together with that, we are also continually minded in Scripture that it is a sovereign and loving God that oversees and orchestrates the affairs of our lives. That there is nothing that happens to us that is not for our good. That He does not work out for our good. That does not conform us greater to an image of Christ. And that does not work to increase our faith in Him. Christians are bound to understand and believe those things. Not when things are always pleasant, but even in the midst of suffering and affliction. When you're like the prophet and you're waiting the bad news that you know is coming, how do you prepare your heart to endure? How do you prepare your heart to continue to trust? Friends, I just don't think that Habakkuk gives us any... It's not legal when you read Habakkuk. It is no longer legal. It's an infraction, punishment being $10 extra every month. If you continue to read Romans 8:28 superficially, God works all things for good to those who love Him, called according to His good purpose. Christians know that. We just throw that out there. And then affliction comes. And then we don't believe that. Pastoral ministry of 25 years has taught me this thing. Lots of people that I consider to be pretty stable Christians fled Christ in the midst of suffering. Why? Because Romans 8:28 was not a promise in the midst of affliction to them. It could not have been. Romans 8:28, that God will work all things out for good, somehow was confused in the mind to think that God would keep only good things coming your way. And that is the things that I consider to be good. I'm talking to a lot of parents here. And I know as parents, when you first have that little gem, that little baby that you've been waiting for 9 months and finally comes into the world and you've got all the medical care and they send you home and then they bring you back and then they take that little baby with your blessing. You give that little child over to some sweet-looking little nurse who then takes that child's foot, bends it up around his knee, and prokes him in a heel. Been there? And he screams bloody murder. I'm surprised that moms have not attacked those women. But it does you everything. If you've been there, dads, it's heartbreaking. You think, my goodness, it's like 3 days old. What are you doing? What are you doing? You're doing something for their good that they cannot possibly understand. Habakkuk prepares himself for a day that's coming. And he does that by turning his attention to the past and seeing how God has always been. He He seeks for God to be that now. He turns his heart because of the future. He turns his heart backwards and he finds hope in God. Nominalism attends church pretty well. Nominalism speaks Christianese pretty well. But my friends, nominalism does not suffer in faith. So how do you prepare for tomorrow's afflictions? Well, I have four things. Preparation for tomorrow's affliction is a matter of personally trusting God today. Now that sounds pretty simple, self-explanatory. What that means is, do not waste the small trials in your life. Do not overlook them as incidental to your spiritual growth. When God brings a headache at work, when God brings a frustration in your marriage, when God brings a relational tension, do not overlook that importance of those events. Those are small times with small potential losses where God can teach you how to trust Him and not yourself, where He can humble us instead of build up our pride, when we become less self-sufficient in those moments instead of more self-sufficient in those moments. So preparing for tomorrow's afflictions is taking seriously the afflictions of today and walking through those things the way Habakkuk did. God, I want to trust you in this. Everything that God has promised to be for me, everything that God has said He would do for me, that the Holy Spirit in me would help bring about reconciliation with people, that is all part of the way we go forward in the small trials, with smaller potential losses, certainly, than what Habakkuk is facing. So don't waste your afflictions. Don't waste them, either by turning them into opportunities to grow in your self-sufficiency and pride, or by just simply ignoring God as if He has nothing to do with this. Put your faith in Him. Secondly, preparation for tomorrow's afflictions is a matter of being convinced that God is good, that God is faithful. Part of the preaching ministry of this church is to constantly put before you the gospel of Jesus Christ. I don't know of any other place, as I turn backwards in history, I don't want to go to the Red Sea. I want to do something more personal than that. I want my thinking to go back to the cross. I want my thinking to go outside of Jerusalem on that faithful Friday, that Friday that God had promised from the very beginning, from Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. And there, as my suffering substitute hangs on the cross for me, as me, I'm looking upon the faithfulness of God. I'm looking upon the goodness of God. I'm reminded that all I have coming to me, according to Romans chapter 5, is that I ought to be separated from God. I was an enemy of God. I was not being faithful to Him. I was not His pal. I was not one who was righteous before the law. Ephesians chapter 2 tells us, we were dead in our trespasses and sins as a consequence of the way we've lived our lives. And yet here is God's gift to us, hanging on a cross. I don't know of anywhere else to go. Of all the struggles of young people, I just want to know that God loves me. I just want to know He can be trusted. Don't forget the gospel. I don't know any other way for us to stir our hearts in that. The heart that believes the gospel, I think it's very difficult not to see the goodness and faithfulness of God. But for those who are still stuck in a confused understanding of the gospel, thinking that it presents just one more way for our works to make us right before God, I think in that person's heart, the questions about God's goodness and faithfulness just abound. Getting the gospel right is getting the character of God right. Getting the character of God right makes the gospel deeper and wider. Preparation, third, preparation for tomorrow's affliction is a matter of being convinced that God's love for you is not ever to be determined by the agreeableness of your present circumstances. God's love for you is to be determined by His covenant that He made with you through the person of Christ. It is not to be determined upon the agreeableness of your circumstances. So every time something gets dark and heavy, you say, well, God hasn't loved me, He's forsaken me. That is so common in America, but it is so wrong. How can God be a father to us if every time something happens to us that we do not agree, we think He has forsaken us forever? Fourthly, preparation for tomorrow's afflictions is a matter of seeing your past through the eyes of faith. That's what we learn from Habakkuk. We must recognize that a proper response to grace that you've experienced in the past is gratitude. And the proper response to grace that He has promised you in the future is faith. As John Piper said, we can be very thankful for past grace, and that makes us confident in future grace. Habakkuk waits for God. He's waiting for affliction, and he prepares himself to trust in God's faithfulness. Now we come to the last point. This is where I really want to press this home. Affliction is no stranger to this congregation. Affliction is no stranger to any congregation. But just off the top of my head, if I forgot your problem, it wasn't intentional, just off the top of my head, I just sat down and wrote out, what do I know that's going on in this congregation? In this congregation, there are families who are praying and serving children who they are related to because of very serious illness in their families. Some are here who have recently living under a great burden of anxiety because they were awaiting the final word of some tests that were potentially quite serious. Some have experienced recent deaths. Others are watching the health of their parents fail so rapidly, they're already talking about needing to go home in order to prepare for a funeral. Family members are struggling with cancer, some others with very serious medical issues. There's question marks over how long will they be with us. Some are dealing with aged parents who haven't provided well financially, and now there's problems and tensions, and they don't live next door, and this becomes quite difficult. Some here, their children have denied the faith of Christ and turned from the gospel. Others are dealing with financial stress, relational stress, family stress, marriage stress. The first response to Habakkuk in the news of affliction was something typical. It said, "Don't you care, God? How could you allow this? Why now? Why this at all?" And then all of a sudden in chapter 3, we see how much growth has taken place when he says, "Even if there is a wholesale economic collapse, I will praise you." So he lists out things that are very important to the Israelite economy. Figs. "Even if there's no figs, I will praise you." They served as kind of a delicacy in Israel. Their loss didn't produce total collapse. They were part of it. He says, "Even if there's no grapes on the vine, I'll praise you." The grapes being the provision of daily drink, but the loss of the fruit of the vine by itself would not be a major disaster. Inconvenient, yes. The olive crop, on the other hand, produced oil for cooking and light. Grain and barley, he mentions, provided the staple diet in Palestine. But even if there's none of those, he said, I'll still praise you. The failure of the fields to produce food might mean starvation for large segments of the population, but when we get down to flocks of sheep and goats, along with the herds of cattle, it made up the backbone of the economy. And though one of these things alone may not have been an absolute disaster, as Habakkuk looks forward to the invasion of the Babylonians, he anticipates the worst possible scenario. He anticipates a wholesale economic collapse. He's anticipating the loss of culture, the loss of his society, the loss of the fear of God. And yet he says, "Even if all of those things happen, God, I will take joy in you because you are the God who saves me." My friends, the distance between chapter 1, 1 and 5 and chapter 3, 17 is a long ways apart. So what happened? Well, Habakkuk had to get very real about suffering. And he was forced to get very real about what he believed to be true about the goodness of God. Some of our thinking about suffering has simply just not been pressed that hard. It's hard to complain about that. You know, it's hard to find fault with that. Certainly wouldn't take that to God. God, you know what the problem is? The reason my faith is so wobbly all the time is because you've kept me from a lot of suffering. That's true, but I don't complain. It's hard to complain about something like that. Habakkuk is forced with a reality that he cannot do anything about. And it's at that point that he doesn't bolt. It's at that point that he digs in. And he says, this is the God that I'm connected to by covenant. This is the God who's revealed himself only in ways that I should take hope in. Habakkuk sees through the difficulties with eyes that have been conditioned to see God as good and trustworthy. And so he says in verse 18, I will rejoice. I will take joy in the God of my salvations. When afflictions come, he's saying to his own soul, it's okay. And it's okay because God has not changed. It's okay because his purposes for me have not changed. It's okay because his love for me has not changed. It's okay because his promises in Christ that I have received as gracious promises given to me have not been altered in the slightest form. One of the strangest characteristics of living in a fallen world, the great purpose of God to redeem me, is that in the midst of afflictions, I need him most, but I often want something else. And I don't get that. A few years ago, those of you who are here, you know that I went through the most difficult time of my life. I don't know what brought it on for sure, but it was about this time. In fact, I missed Christmas with you. I was afflicted by a dark, stubborn cloud of hopelessness. The inversion of the valley entered into my soul and it didn't leave. And it didn't leave for 3 months. And day after day, I struggled to find just a verse in the Bible that might bring hope to my depleted soul. And some days I didn't find it. And day after day, looking for some reason to keep moving forward, I realized, just look around, I'm not alone. But it seemed like I was alone. It seemed like it was all gone. It was affliction. But even through that darkness, there was something that I could still see. There was a hope. I was still firing on some pistons of hope. I was still getting into the Word every day. I was still crying out to God. I had nothing else to do. God, if you don't fix this mess. This mess, this is over. I didn't know if I'd come back here. I didn't know if I'd go back into ministry. Those were dark days. And yet through all the irrational tears of doubt and fear and darkness, I could still see something. And now 2 years later, I don't miss that darkness. I got a little happy light on my desk. That thing goes most of the day. If I could do a vitamin D plus injection, I would just do that every day. I just have an IV. But you know, I miss the desperation. Is that weird? I actually miss it. I miss that all day long, my only job, you all are very kind to pay me for this, my job was to find God. That was it. And that's pretty much by the end of the day, that's about all I did. On the good days, I found him. In a verse out of context, I found him. I remember taking great confidence in the story of Lazarus, that Jesus is the one who raises the dead. There were other verses that were very, very important to me. My point in this is this. I asked our small group last week, what if God, who we all know as our Father, wanted to do just one thing that we all would agree would be good? What if our Father wanted to just break our squeeze on the comforts of this life? Well, what if you were God, and in a loving way, you wanted to reduce how tight we hold on to this world? What would you do? And all of a sudden, through our minds, went all kinds of things that none of us want. Well, one of the most obvious things, if you want to break our death squeeze on comforts, is you start taking them away. Well, who really wants that? And maybe it's not good enough to take them away slowly so that we might just think that it was our own error that we lost them. Maybe we should take them all away really fast so that we know they're gone. Well, who wants to sign up for that? I mean, we can't get people to sign up to, like, serve each other. Who wants that? But do you see how God can be a Father and love us, even in times that are disagreeable to us? And do you see, church, that He has to do that to love us? Do you understand that if God never does that to us, never puts us in a spot we really don't like, He doesn't put us there and watch and see if we produce well, as if He's ready to squash us. He puts us in those places because He's committed to walk with us through that. If God never does that, if He's always waiting around for only those things we would approve of, do you realize how much in love with this world we would be by the end of this life? Do you realize how self-sufficient we might be in this life? Do you realize that just like the world, we would have nothing else to live for except for how much we can acquire in this life, in this short time that we're here? There would be nothing else to live for, and yet a loving Father whose real heart is that we don't hold on to this world so tightly still gives us good things so that we can have them for His glory, so that we don't hold on to them so tightly. Afflictions come in and teach us these things are not our hope. And when afflictions come, it is an irrational Christian thought that God has deserted us. My friends, if I could just convince you of that through Habakkuk, the 4 weeks would be so worth spending on this particular prophet. All right, we need to come to a close here. My friends, a church that lives trusting God in times of loss and affliction, a church that still celebrates ultimate things, ultimate good things, even when temporal things have been taken away, a church that values being placed by God's providence into positions of weakness, so that we might experience His strength in us, is a church that truly lives by trust in the faithfulness of God. That's a church that truly lives by trust in the faithfulness of God. That's the church I want to be part of, and I know that's the church you want to be part of. That's the church that puts Christ on display. That's the church that does not make sense in the light of the world. That we would willingly say, God, it's okay to take that away because You are teaching me something to love something better. My own confession, sometimes I need affliction just simply to get my desires back on course. And when that happens, the afflictions come so that my desires are back on course, so that I have the right priorities again, I don't stand and shake my fist at God and say, how dare you? It's the only response of faith to say, thank you, God. And only faith can understand that. This morning we're coming to the table. These symbols of the bread and the wine are not just religious, empty symbols. It's not a ritual. They point us to the body and blood of Christ. It's a table of God's goodness. It's a table of His faithfulness. It's a table of grace. We participate in it often because grace, and by grace, this table speaks to us. The question for all of us is, what does it say? Well, it's a table of a covenant promise. It says, I have provided everything for you. It says, my purpose for you, they are perfect. It says, I have begun something, I have committed myself to complete in you. It does not say, those of you who have arrived and are perfect may come forward. It says, come unto me, all of you who have realized that you're too weak to make it in your own self-sufficiency. Come unto me, all of you who are under a burden, and you will find rest. Not in you, in Him. It is a table of Christ. If you'd all stand with me as those leaders would come forward. Friends, this is a table of faith. It's a time for us to ask, am I really trusting Him? It's a table of promise. It says He's committed Himself to you for next week and next month. It's a table that sustains us. Father, I pray this morning.